I'm Monica Malpass on Inside Story. Chicago is now suing the federal government over sanctuary cities. Should Philadelphia follow suit? Let's get the inside story. Good morning. Welcome to Inside Story. Let's meet our insiders. And today we have George Burrell, a nonprofit executive.
Morning,
good morning, sir. Welcome back to you. Christine Flowers, journalist and attorney. Glad to have you again, Chris.
Morning, Monica.
Donna Gentile O'Donnell, who is a nonprofit executive.
Good morning,
Donna.
Monica.
Thanks for being here. And Val DiGiorgio, GOP state official. Always great to have you as well, Val.
Good morning, Monica.
We're really talking about two competing visions of how to go about public safety. And should we have sanctuary cities continuing as a policy, which has been an ongoing controversy with the federal government, whether they're getting the rights they deserve towards immigrants or whether cities in fact feel like they should provide a safe haven. Chicago's now taken it to another level and filed a lawsuit saying you cannot stop our funding because we're just trying to keep public safety issues. Philadelphia has some of the same rub. Should we jump on the bandwagon?
Monica, you know, I do this every day. I'm in the trenches on immigration. And so I have a sort of like a bottom-up view of this. And I have a problem with both extremes on this issue. We have people who do not only want to limit illegal immigration, but also legal immigration. And so what they're doing is they're conflating criminal activity with illegality, with your legal status. There is absolutely no correlation there. On the other hand, you have immigrant advocates who are unwilling to even acknowledge the fact that that you need some kind of cooperation among all of the public safety officials and officers to keep everyone, including those who may not be here in a documented way, safe. I do tend to agree with those who argue, though, that if an immigrant, legal or illegal, feels that they're in danger of being arrested and or deported by ICE if they go and report a crime, that makes our communities unsafe.
So and what's the answer then? Where do we go next?
In terms of what's actually going on the ground, there's this misconception that city government is not turning over people with criminal records that are immigrants to ICE, and that's just false. There are several instances in which someone has been identified as a criminal and they're here illegally, and that information has been turned over to ICE. Where the mayor and others are drawing the line, I think, is in the space that Christine is talking about, which is that space in which you have to exercise some kind of moral discretion. But the other thing that I think is worth noting with respect to Chicago, so it's very likely Philadelphia is, the mayor is speaking to, our mayor is speaking to Mayor Emanuel.
Right.
They are having conversations about how to work together. Our mayor acknowledges that there are various levels of sanctuary city. You know, we've got one type, they've got something else. Every city has a different orientation to how they do this. And so there's certainly a high probability at a minimum of an amicus. There may be more activity on the side of the city, but there's broadly recognition that Philadelphia needs to be participative in this.
We're talking about millions of dollars, George, 2.3 at least for Chicago, a couple million for Philadelphia.
It's a modest amount of money in the great scheme of things, but it's an important amount of money. The sanctuary city debate is a legitimate debate. Michael Nutter had a different view of it than Jim Kenney has of it. But in my judgment, that should be worked, how it gets reconciled should be worked out in the courts, and the Trump administration should not be blackmailing cities by threatening to withhold funds if you don't conform to their view of the world. They've had litigation, I think, in San Francisco and a couple of other cities with respect to this. It will get resolved in that litigation posture. But the president campaigned on helping Chicago solve its crisis, and now they're trying to blackmail them to get $2.3 million.
Right.
And I think it's unfair of the attorney general to suggest, you know, this rhetoric that we get into in politics these days, to suggest that somehow, because the mayor of Chicago and the city of Chicago does not conform to the sanctuary city requirements, or somehow abandoning their responsibility to protect their city. That's obnoxious.
And
well,
no surprise,
see,
hold
statistics?
On, that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, supports, of course, the president's stance on this. So, Val, where does that leave us? Because it's also Seattle and Richmond and Santa Clara County, California.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a euphemism here on George's part that we're not conforming. You know, federal law, feds handle some things and the states handle some things. Imagine a patchwork of laws where everyone decides what they want to do on issues that are constitutionally delegated to the federal government. In case of immigration, you can't have every city and every state deciding what their own immigration policies are. So we've had this debate in the 60s on civil rights. federal government has a role in certain areas, and they have the right to enforce those laws. Second, this is a dangerous situation where in a report, in a government accountability report in 2011 said that you had 250,000 illegal immigrants committing over 2 million crimes. And crimes of rape, murder, you know, on and on, drug arrests.
There are so
and,
many, and please, Christine.
You cannot, as a mayor, say, I am not going to comply with ICE's requirements. You
but,
just can't
but,
do
but,
it.
But the other thing is, and Val, I understand your concern, but, and you actually made my point for me when you said you cannot have a patchwork system. It is not within the purview of local municipalities to enforce federal immigration
but nobody
policy.
Wants rapes and murders either.
They,
so we
they
gotta
don't,
have a.
But what are the statistics of
there's
illegal?
There's a law that says
illegal,
that the local governments now. Have to comply. Law enforcement has to comply with ICE on
it. It is
it's
not.
On the books
it is
in,
not
in the
code.
Constitution.
There's
a law on the books,
the
Christine, that says that
it does not.
All right, hold on. Go ahead.
At the end of the day, that's why we have courts. In the civil rights fight, we had to go to court to fight against laws that were on the books that people thought were unfair and inappropriate. That's why you have courts here to resolve this dispute. And but the federal government should not be blackmailing cities and withholding necessary funding.
But also,
they should not be blackmailing cities and withholding funding that allow them to fight
exactly.
the crime that they're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. And compliance, what you're talking about, Val, is there are levels of compliance, just as Donna said.
There's compliance. No, there are,
no it's not.
Lawyer,
it's
there's
not
compliance,
step,
number
Val,
one.
Val,
okay,
number
it's
two,
not
two,
Val,
as far as blackmail,
ahead.
Blackmail is an unfortunate term. Nobody said it was blackmail when the Kennedy administration, the Eisenhower administration, rightly went into the South and said, you have to comply with federal law or we're going to bring in the troops.
On
That's
civil
not
rights.
Blackmail. Right. So it's not blackmail.
They went there
term.
Because people weren't complying with the law.
Correct. That's
they
what's
weren't doing
with
exactly
ICE.
What you're
That's
suggesting.
That's what's happening with ICE.
Exactly.
The local governments are not complying with ICE requirements.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Required
if
to
I,
by statute.
If I can, if I just let me add one point. We watched a number of failures on immigration legislation at the federal level. Mm-hmm. We had Republican legislators and Democratic legislators in Congress who tried to move something else forward, and they failed. This is an abject legislative congressional failure, but it's relevant because these people's lives hang in the balance.
By the way, do you guys know what happened to Joe Arpaio, who supposedly was complying with the law? That guy was going well beyond what the mandate was supposed to be. He was going out and deliberately, in a discriminatory manner, looking for people who looked a certain way and thought, well, you know what? These guys, they got to be illegal aliens. They committed specific
racial
crimes.
Racial profiling.
He has been held in
That's
contempt
a different
of
issue
court.
From what
All
we're
right,
talking
hold on.
About.
It's Val's last point.
You're talking
ahead,
about
Val.
Compliance.
Let's
You're talking about
Go
compliance.
Ahead.
When ICE comes and says, are you holding on detainer illegal aliens, and a mayor says no or law enforcement says no, that's a violation of the law, clear and simple, number one. Number two, this is a 70% issue across the United States. Poll after poll, and I've seen them, say that people do not like the sanctuary city policy. And if Democrats want to run on that next year, you know, we'll take them, the Republican Party will take them on, and we're going to win on that issue. Toomey did last year. We're going to win on that issue again next year.
All right, let's move on and talk about two seats that could be in play. At least Democrats are hoping that they are in this area. Two incumbents, Pat Meehan, the congressman from Delaware, Republican as well, and incumbent congressman Mike Fitzpatrick, also a Republican from Bucks County. Both those seats are seen as vulnerable because of the Trump coattails, at least according to Democrats, and they're putting some money and effort into trying to unseat those two. What's the likelihood? What's the vulnerability of those two seats? This is an area where you know a lot about it.
Yeah, there's seats that are in play. I mean, Pat Meehan has shown himself to be a very deft legislator who represents his district. Fitzpatrick, the same thing. They're voting their district right now. I know there's some people in my party aren't happy with them. That's actually going to serve them well with moderates in the suburbs. Pat Meehan holds us. He's got the most money on hand of almost any congressman in the nation, certainly any in Pennsylvania. These are two skilled legislators who I think will survive. These races will be in play, but we're ready to defend them.
So Democrats trying to do town halls, also using health care, obviously, as one of the controversial bullet points in their list of areas of discomfort.
Well, one of the big problems on our side of the aisle is that we're going to have aggressive primaries in which we're going to have Democratic candidates challenging each other. And in those primaries, it's very likely to yield the kind of content that then gives rise to more conflict in the head-on-head race for the general election. My biggest concern on the Democratic side is we need to be vetting good candidates to run, and we need to figure out a way to consolidate primaries in such a way that we're behind a candidate. I'm especially focused on that race in Wisconsin, where I think a rising candidate is going to be able to do that and maybe take out Paul Ryan.
And how do you feel about the methods? The Democrats are trying some new things with Google Ads. Whenever you, you know, type in the word, even congressman or health care, up pops some information and it could lead you to their website.
Well, I think there are going to be a whole host of efforts to muddy the waters with respect to candidates. And I think that, you know, the issue is when you get down to all of these issues, the question is, do voters still want change? And is there a frustration level out there that's going to feed into that change? Most people forget that when Barack Obama was elected president of the United States, they were having the same discussion in the Republican Party about total disarray. Where are we going? Who are our leaders? 10 years later, the Democrats are in the same place that Republicans were then. And the question for next year is, do voters still want change? And I think they do. And who's going to be able to define and respond to that as a matter of political messaging?
All right, speaking of campaign, let's talk about the DA's race in Philadelphia. It's pitting lots of people, two candidates per se, but the people behind them are the ones really now the focus is on. So it's a matter of which side that you're interested in. And at this point, it's Larry Krasner, backed by many people say George Soros, put a lot of money behind him. That's how he beat out that large field of other candidates, six others. And then, of course, Beth Grossman, who's running. And now she's gotten a former Philly, Kurt Schilling on the radio waves, talking about her campaign. Do you think the battle of the famous people is going to help out in this case?
I've interviewed Beth Grossman as well. She's extremely articulate and she has a very strong, I think, a centrist vision for the city, which is important in this particular race, because with this particular Democratic candidate, Larry Krasner, you have someone at the extreme leftward fringes of the Democratic Party who is representing the prosecutor's office, the law and order branch of the government. And unfortunately, during the primaries, it didn't appear that very many of the Democratic candidates were really talking more about the issues that, you know, the quality of life, the victim, how crime affects the victims. And it almost sounded as if they were vying for public defender office, chief defender. Beth Grossman, I think, has an opportunity because she does have the backing of the FOP. And she does have sort of like a large, diverse backing, both demographically and I think politically. I think she has an opportunity to really wrest this position from a guy who is seen as, by many, including myself, extremely radical.
It's an uphill climb. It's a 7-1 registration advantage, and Larry Krasner is the Democratic nominee. So what do you make of the actual struggle ahead we're going to be watching?
While I think it's true that during the primary there was a lot of disconnects and there were some angry people that George Soros had funded Larry Krasner, there is an equal balancing force out there, which is that I don't think we've ever seen a time when people who live in large cities have been more distrustful of institutions that govern them. And I think that works to Larry Krasner's advantage. In addition to that, he's also wrapped up endorsements from the big unions, the LGBTQ community, and a number of other really important folks on the Democratic side of the equation, that if you didn't have them, if they were off the reservation, then you'd have a different kind of problem.
But, and he was a defense attorney for 30 years, specifically on civil rights cases, which
notably, Michael Cord, who's one of the most significant black activists in the city, has been out front for this guy during the primary, made it really clear that that Krasner was going to bring something important to the table that the black community needed in a period of time in which they feel under siege.
And what's in this for George Soros, George?
I don't know what George Soros is.
Why would he put one point here?
I don't know. But he's done this around the country and other places. And so he's into law enforcement. He's into perhaps change in speaking for minority communities who believe that district attorney offices and attorney general offices have worked against them. I think Larry Krasner would have won without the Soros money. I think he had capably defined himself as a change agent, which people are looking for. I think people respect the fact that he brings that defender perspective. He understands that. And he reflects change in the same way that Josh Shapiro got himself elected Attorney General in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania without any prosecutorial background, because people think he represents
Monica,
change.
We have an adversarial position. This is an adversarial system, and you cannot have two individuals who seem to be aligned with the defense, who seem to be aligned with the offender, as opposed to having someone who is out there for the people. You know, it's always the Commonwealth versus, it's not the victim versus, it's the Commonwealth versus a defendant. And so having someone someone like Larry Krasner, I actually think that having all of the activists for, you know, the minority communities and victims, not victims groups, the those who feel that there has been an unfair sense of prosecution on the part of the DA's office is actually going to hurt him with respect to people thinking that he's going to be a serious prosecutor.
But if prosecutors can go to be defense attorneys, why can't a defense attorney go to be a prosecutor?
Fair play. All right, we're going to take a break. Inside Story continues right after this. Stick around.
Inside Story is presented by Temple University. Remarkable change isn't easy, but for those who take charge, it comes naturally. Explore Temple's impact. Visit temple.edu/impact.
Welcome back to Inside Story. Talking about Pennsylvania's state budget, we have a $32 billion budget, $2 billion hole that still has to be filled. Right now, legislators have been borrowing money to fill the gap. They're not going to be able to do that forever and still debating what other options they have. Ironic in a way that last year or last budget, the new governor couldn't get one that everybody liked. This time he's in sync with the Senate, but the House can't come around. What is the deal, Val?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily realistic to say he's in sync with the Senate. He's made a deal with the Senate that he can live with. He'd want much more spending.
Right.
Interesting about this is the governor's been largely AWOL in the negotiations. So they've tried to have five-party talks. The governor hasn't even been in town. We've documented that. Governor needs to show some leadership as a chief executive to bring people together, even though he's from the other party.
But what's up with the House?
I see George snickering already.
So why can't the House come on board? What's the issue?
The House has a different view of what should be happening in the Commonwealth. They believe that they don't want any more tax increases. Pennsylvanians are taxed enough. They think we can find cuts. Then they want to find cuts, and they don't want to do it with borrowing. So that's what their voters sent them to do, and they're representing their district.
Well, George, you're laughing, so here.
Look, this is the failure between, I mean, everybody always wants to point to the governor, and I've been critical of the governor when he's warranted criticism. But he's cut a deal with the Republicans, and the Republicans themselves can't cut a deal with their partners in the state House. And it takes that triangle, and the governor's on vacation, he says, well, the state House is on vacation. They're not there, and you know, they get the scuttlebutt of they've had these private conversations. In fact, they said they had a private conversation with the Senate leadership and the governor and the House leadership during this period, and nothing came of it. They weren't negotiations, said the House leadership, but they were discussions. But this is a Republican problem where there is a dramatic difference. They have the same fundamental principles, I believe, but they have to balance the budget.
Right, and in the squeeze, or state colleges and other groups that may lose their funding or may get short shrifted?
There are a lot of people that are gonna get hurt if governing occurs. But I wanna be clear about something. I mean, to characterize the governor as AWOL, I think is inaccurate and unfair. I mean, it's not like he's off in Europe. He's available to be participating. He's available. Yeah, but Val, it's an hour drive. You and I drive that drive. Come on. I mean, that's a little disingenuous. So what? He's in the Commonwealth. He's talking to people that he needs to talk to.
You got
to
be there engaging
with legislators. What do you think is the answer? How do we fill that gap?
So Dave Reed on the House side is trying to have something pulled together by the end of August. Personally, I think trying to do anything by the end of August is like herding cats. But I admire the fact that he's at least making an attempt to get something pulled together by the end of August. Whether or not it happens is unclear. But there's pain here. There's going to be pain for a lot of people.
Right. Let's talk about school funding now, because it's dependent on the state as well. And the SRC running Philadelphia schools is nothing new. But there's new talk every year about should the SRC be gotten rid of? Should we get a new board to somehow make these decisions? Philadelphia actually has never had its own board. It's been state run for a long time. What's the answer? Because that's a $3 billion budget, that half of which comes from the state and half from the city.
Right. Well, there's always been this desire on the part of Philadelphia for self-governance, but you know, the SRC can only dissolve itself. And Estelle Richmond, one of the new members, indicated that she would be willing for them to dissolve. But then what happens if you don't have a backup plan? You don't have a board, a school district.
A vacuum of leadership, right?
Exactly. Well, so, I mean, it's nice to talk about getting rid of it, but what's plan B?
Well, also, I think it's useful to remember that in the rest of the if we're talking about an elected school board, the governor talked about an elected school board, other people in leadership on both sides of the aisle have talked about that. But in other counties around the Commonwealth, an elected school board is a smaller subset of a county. I mean, Philadelphia is the only county and city of the first class. We're the only county that has that status. But the question then recurs, how would you construct it? Would it be by councilmanic district? Each councilmanic district has an elected board. Because frankly, to try and govern, I think part of the problem is that what is at work here is something that is so large and unwieldy that it's very difficult.
And how do you keep people from being available for pay-to-play issues of bribery? How do you keep one group honest versus the other?
That's a very big issue.
But the problem here is that the SRC is supposed to be the embodiment of the state running public education in Philadelphia. There is no evidence whatsoever that the state is actually running public education or engaged in the process. The fact is that the SRC was appointed at a time when John Purcell and Dwight Evans were the powers in Harrisburg, and Governor Schweiker was talking about all Philadelphia's children being Pennsylvania's children. There was a different set of dynamics, different finances, a different set of dynamics. Now the people who are running Harrisburg have no direct relationship. So the SRC actually functions on an island, and there is no one with the real power to govern education in Philadelphia.
But there's a lot of money on the line, Val.
Well, you know, almost $2 billion comes from the state. The state wants to have some stake in education. I think George is right. It was done at a time when Dwight and John Purcell, two powerhouses from the city, were caring about Philadelphia education. We need people in Harrisburg who care about Philadelphia education. That's important. We need some state oversight. Look, it was put together at a time when the school district was financially collapsing and kids were not being educated. Nothing has changed since then.
Yeah.
So what are we going to replace it with? I think it needs to be done in a bipartisan way. Mm-hmm. I think people around the state do care about Philadelphia kids getting educated, but they want to see some reform to the system before we spend $1.8 billion of taxpayer money on the system.
All right, we're going to leave it at that. Inside Stories of the Week coming your way next. Stick around.
Inside Story is presented by Temple University. Remarkable change isn't easy, but for those who take charge, it comes naturally. Explore Temple's impact. Visit temple.edu/impact.
Welcome back. Time for Inside Stories of the Week, and let's start with George.
Although there's support in the community, there's also frustration in minority communities that when an epidemic like the opioid epidemic impacts the majority community in a significant way, that the federal government can find $45 billion and state governments can find money to directly address that issue, but are not addressing issues like poverty and education and other ones in the same way.
So where was the money when the other community needed it? All right, Christine.
Monica, when I was 18, I registered as a Democrat, like my family, and for 35 years I remained in the Democratic Party, even though I was very, very disappointed with what I saw, an increasing opposition, hostility to pro-life members. I left. Now I'm happy to note that the DNC has just announced that they are no longer going to put a ban on supporting pro-life Democratic candidates. It's important for them to understand that there may be some Democrats out there who would vote for pro-life candidates. So maybe I'll re-register as a Democrat.
Okay,
oh my
Donna.
Goodness. So Atlantic City used to be, in its earliest incarnation, a place that was focused on health and wellness. And few people would think of it in that way these days, given the hard times that it's fallen on and the orientation of the city. But there's a small but exciting little thing going on the Atlantic City Boardwalk, supported by the city, Tropicana, and AtlanticCare Gym. We're doing Zumba on the Boardwalk at noon on Friday, Saturday, and 10 o'clock on Sunday. If you missed it this week, come next week. It's free. It's a ball. Maricela Dellinger is a great leader, Zumba leader, and
getting good health.
Get it in it early in the morning.
All right, Val.
One thing I've been dealing with as a state GOP chair is a narrative that the media, when they call me, is trying to push that we're somehow on our heels in the Republican Party across the state. In the region, registrations are proceeding as they have been, pretty much on an even par in the counties, but at the national level, we're seeing RNC outpacing DNC donations by 2-1, and small donors by 50% more. And for those who aren't good with percentages, that's 1.5-1. So we're alive. The Republican Party's alive and well across
all
the
right
country.
Good to know. That's Inside Story for this week. Thank you so much for watching. Hope you'll be right back here next Sunday morning. Thanks to our panelists. Everybody have a great week ahead. See you then.